Welcome back to part two of Air Quality Matters and my conversation with Francesca Brady. One of the interesting things that's factoring more and more, and I guess you must see it, is the influence that ESG is having on businesses making decisions on inward investment into infrastructure, but also categorizing and labeling the performance of assets. Yeah. I guess that's a very real conversation for you now.
It is. And coming back to that point about getting a foot in the door, ESG is actually a really good vehicle for that, because I think with indoor air quality, yes, it quite naturally falls under E, but if you are strategically and intentionally wanting to exercise the value of doing something for indoor air quality, then you'll promote what you're doing through education, communication. And then it falls into S. And I think S is social is a difficult section of ESG. So environmental, relatively straightforward. It's easier to understand what you might be able to do that's going to have a positive impact, a quantifiable impact for environment. S, ambiguous. G, governance, that also feels very matter of fact. Pretty straightforward. Obviously, executing all these things is a different matter, but it's easy to quantify. With social, it's always been a bit of a misnomer. People don't really know how to treat it. If we're doing things, we don't want to be seen as greenwashing. And particularly with the social part of ESG, it is the one that's under most scrutiny for greenwashing. So if you're able to quantify it in some way, you can say, well, we've done all of this messaging around a data-driven, performance-driven assessment for indoor air quality, and X number of people interacted and engaged with this content, then that's quite a nice way to start trying to quantify social impact. So I think with the likes of GRESB, so Global Real Estate Sustainability Benchmark, that is an ESG benchmarking system that a lot of large-scale businesses use, particularly those that own global portfolios and that are, I guess, more specifically centered in Europe, because it's a European-centric benchmarking system. It's really interesting with that, because there is a section in GRESB for building certifications. So if you go through a couple of rounds of due diligence as an air quality certification provider, then you're listed as an air quality certification that can gain clients who are submitting to GRESB points towards their GRESB submission to strengthen their score and, in theory, improve the value of their fund and their assets. Brilliant. Where there is a slight, again, gap in knowledge that we are trying to have conversations with the likes of GRESB around is, yes, we can be pigeonholed into building certification, but actually Fitwel, the WELL standard, Aerated, a whole bunch of them spill out over into stakeholder management, into tenant and community, into risk management. But it's identifying the way that it does that in a meaningful manner, not just to gain more points for the sake of gaining more points, but in a very real, tangible way. How does it feed into these other areas? Because if you're doing a certification that's geared towards indoor air quality, fundamental determinant for human health, there are so many aspects that it can fall into. And if the weighting for something like that was greater than, I don't want to discredit any other certifications, something that didn't quite have the same impact as air. So, and we always talk about this when it's looking at certifications. With an air quality specific certification, everyone in the building cares. So it's not just a specific group of people. Again, I'm not going to talk about any certifications in particular, but you do get those that specific groups of people would have a vested interest in knowing more about, or making sure that it had a specific type of rating if you were that way inclined. With air quality, theoretically, everyone should benefit from it. So it would be good to see something like that, something like a healthy building certification that looks at light, water quality, air quality, have a much greater weighting than perhaps some of the others. And that's not to say that obviously sustainability isn't as important. It is. So I think it would just be a case of, on a case-by-case basis, understanding, yes, that all of these sit under building certifications, but how much do they feed into other areas that are also being reported on, and weight them that way.
I think that it demonstrates the challenge at a European level, for example, that it's been, I say relatively, I mean, it was still a no mean feat to get the EU taxonomy embedded, and that is without question having impacts on investment decisions, and ultimately money makes the world go round. And if large investors in real estate are making decisions to invest and divest out of certain portfolios based on the environmental risk that they present long term, because these funds thinking pension fund timeframes, so they're looking at everything from a 2030 2050 perspective anyway. So they're very matter of fact and non-emotional in this. They're making decisions on the types of buildings they invest in based on how they're likely to be valued in 2030 and 2050 by the nature of how they operate. But we're seeing rolling in behind that the social taxonomy type frameworks, where we're starting to frame now exactly what we mean by these social impacts. And what happens subtly in the background is we define the framing, but what rolls in behind that are the thresholds and the values and the benchmarks that you have to meet. And that's what we're starting to see now, I think, with the likes of GRESB and some of the other ratings, that they're now valuing the S in the ESG. And these investment funds are looking at a 30-year track on an asset and going, how's this property likely to be valued in 2050? The demographic that's going to be living in it or buying it or renting it or working in it, are they likely to value air quality? Is that going to have an impact in the value of this property? And I think the resounding answer is yes. And it's not as seen, it's not as public, I don't think, that dialogue. But I think if you have those conversations with those organisations, it's front and centre.
It is. And coming back to one of your very first questions about whether I thought COVID was a pro or a con for indoor air quality awareness and change, the reason I much prefer this introduction via ESG, via productivity benefits, is that they all have a much longer term play at the forefront of the conversation. With COVID, obviously, none of us are naive enough to think this will never happen again. But for the most part, when you can't see it, it's not really happening. But when you are constantly valuing assets, constantly valuing funds, constantly looking at productivity metrics, that's something that's always at the front of conversations. And it's a really healthy thing to have. And it's good that you have these pension funds, because they own a huge amount of real estate across the world. It's great that they're getting on board with it, because if they're making changes at asset level, and occupiers start to see, okay, well, the asset's doing this, so if we kind of want a standardized approach to things, maybe those landlords need to be talking to the occupiers and saying, we probably need to get on the same page with this. Because what you don't necessarily want to end up happening is the landlord's got their own kind of siloed strategy, the occupier's doing their own thing as well. Actually, those two groups of people should be working much closer together and be on the same page when it comes to interventions, management, operation, continuous performance and assessment. They all need to be working in harmony together rather than this kind of siloed approach. So if the decisions are being driven by ESG impact on valuation, and you get the landlord buy-in, and then that filters down to occupiers, that's great, because also it'll filter down to the decision maker level at occupier, rather than having this almost perceived desire to get the mass population to care and then have decisions made from the ground up, which is just so, so slow. So it feels like this is a much faster, more efficient, longer term strategic route for profound change, as opposed to waiting for everyone to catch up with the messaging around gender equality.
Yeah, and ultimately you've got to understand who your stakeholders are, and so much of the built environment is a split incentive scenario. So we have to be able to frame the use cases for all the types of stakeholders in those spaces to build the business case. Break down the philosophy for me of the aerated standard. What was your kind of mission when you first conceived of this rating and the gap that you saw that it needed to fill?
So I think, selfishly, my academic background was indoor air quality. So when I first started out in my career, it wasn't necessarily diving straight first into indoor air quality, but it was going into the smart buildings world. And then some of the sensors had indoor air quality data. So it was like, okay, well, I know about this, and how can I communicate this in a way that perhaps isn't being used right now? Because it was all geared towards operational efficiency. So if CO2 goes above 1,000, you need to get it down below 800. And it's like, well, one, what is CO2? Because maybe the understanding for most people with CO2 is greenhouse gas. So like, it's the same gas, different context in the internal environment. So what is it? Where does it come from? How can I reduce it? Because I don't even know what CO2 is in the first place. So it was all around the communication with indoor air quality. And then, one, two, skip a few. Had a few conversations around Fitwel and the WELL standard. I took my Fitwel ambassador exam, and there was a little bit on air quality. I obviously studied a lot more the air quality stuff, personal interest. And then it was a conversation with a chap called Ollie Spriggs, who works at CBRE, and he basically said, could you have an EPC? This is where that energy performance certification conversation came from. Could you have an EPC, but for air? It's like an air performance certificate. And I was like, well, from a scientific perspective, yes, you can. And I know how to make that. And then when we were talking about, okay, well, why is this more attractive than things out there that already have air quality as part of what they do? And it was more about, when you're looking at lots of different aspects of a healthy building, sometimes the message is really diluted, because you're having to talk about water, light, air, nutrition, mental health, all in the same couple of sentences. We were like, if we've got a laser focus on indoor air quality, what's stopping us being the de facto for people to come to with regards to air quality? That's a great position to be in. But also, we can keep the communication and the education so specific that it's meaningful, it's easy to understand. We don't just like randomly start talking about circular economy or material selection. It's all very much geared towards indoor air quality. The number one determinant for human health. I come back to that again. So it was so important to everyone in the building, air quality. We could have a laser focus. We could enter the market in the healthy buildings realm at a lower price point, because we were looking at one aspect of a healthy building. And whilst a healthy building is much more than just air quality, it was a really good entry point. Because if we could get to all buildings, not just the flagship buildings, the shiny big buildings in London — I know this was one of your points earlier when we were having this brief for the call — was how do you tap into the regional assets and the little kind of the occupier with 10 desks down in a tiny office in Southampton? How do you get into them and promote healthy buildings, or something around healthy buildings, to an occupier of that size and make it accessible? And we were like, well, brilliant. That's what we can bring to the healthy buildings world, is the very accessible, from a simplicity perspective, from a communications perspective, and more importantly, from a price perspective, how can we be the accessible one? That is like the gateway drug. Wrong phrase to use, probably, I'm sure. But we can be the stepping stone. And then if an organization wants to explore health in a broader sense, then there are certifications for that. So it was a great position to be in because we weren't directly competing with certifications in the healthy building arena, because Fitwell look at 10 different parameters, the WELL standard look at 12. So we were indirectly competing because we're competing for the same budget, organizations' budgets. But what we wanted to promote was, okay, we are part of the healthy buildings puzzle. We want to work with you. We want to form crosswalks. We want to do as much as possible that's collaborative. And we want to work in harmony with you guys, not against you, because that's not the purpose of us coming to play.
Yeah.
But if you can have these big flagships, much larger scale buildings that do the big fancy certifications, and then, but you can have one that benchmarks the entire portfolio from your biggest 40 story asset down to your little half a floor in Southampton, then that's great, because you can benchmark all your assets with one metric. It's around air quality. It's a really good measure to have. And that's kind of where we thought we had a part to play in this world. And actually, it's worked out really nicely because we've never had anything but good conversations with other certification providers. It's never been a us and them. It's always been, okay, how can we work better together? Knowing that most of our clients are going to pursue air rated or an air score and another.
That's really interesting. And it's very analogous actually to conversations I have in a number of sectors where there's an omnipresent nature to air quality, that it doesn't distinguish between assets. Every asset you own, you need to be thinking about ventilation and air quality. So it's a it's a fascinating, like you say, gateway drug or starting point to bring something with laser focus that is ultimately systemic, because there isn't a part of your organization it doesn't impact on. So what, you know, fascinating conversation with housing I often have is that, look, start with a ventilation strategy, an air quality strategy for your assets, because it will impact on your voids teams, on your reactive maintenance teams, on your new development teams, on your condensation damp and mold teams. There isn't a part of your organization, your customer service teams even, and your housing officers, all of them have the potential and have an interest in outcomes when it comes to ventilation and air quality. Start there, because often what a lot of this stuff is with these standards is the starting point for framing change management, organizational change management, ultimately, because you don't get to change the built environment without changing the organization in some way. And the danger is if it's too broad a stroke when you start, it's a 2-year change management, 10-year change management process that is just overwhelming. Yeah. Whereas if you can say, look, this is really important, we'll put a laser focus on this, start here, and you may well find that actually some of the policies and framing processes that you put in place to deal with this, you can replicate in other ways for other things like sound or light or nutrition or whatever it is.
And it's one of those things. I was listening to a podcast the other day that was talking about procrastination. So you're not doing things, you're not making decisions because something feels too much. It's overwhelming. And I do feel like business decision makers can be put in the same position where, and it's not even just talking about healthy buildings is overwhelming. That is overwhelming as a concept if you don't come from the space. But also, you're not just having to only think about that. You're thinking about so many other things. So if it's saying, okay, well, air quality is step one, so this is where we're going to start, and you only need to spend this amount of time, this amount of money to make this much improvement. So let's just start there. And it's not like you're saying to them, this is where you start, now go off and do it. It's like, this is where you start, this is how you do it, let us help you. Because I think that's what's lacking in some of the revisions, adjustments, amendments to regulation, is that a lot of them will say, okay, you should do this. They don't really tell you how to implement it. And in most cases, they don't go far enough. So, and this is kind of tangential now, but particularly with something like Part F. Yes, great. It was revised. Yes, great. CO2 monitoring's in there. Is that it? Because really, it took a decade to update. Are we now going to wait another decade before temperature and humidity are included in that? Are we going to wait another decade before you undertake annual assessment for PM2.5 and specific speciated VOCs? It's one of those things that if you were a business decision maker, you'd be like, okay, well, here's what I need to do. I'll follow regs. But it's just not quite enough, which is where it's our responsibility as the air quality industry to say, here's a bite-sized chunk. Here's exactly how you do it. And it's up to you to find the budget. You're in charge of where you pull the money from, but here's exactly what you need to do. And we're going to make it as straightforward as possible. So you don't get that kind of procrastination. I don't know what to do. I don't know where to start. So I'm just going to ignore it. Because I think that is probably how a lot of people feel. It's like, oh, I don't have to do anything, so I won't. No one's asking me just yet, so I won't do anything. It's like, well, it's just a matter of time. So actually, you're delaying the inevitable. And let us help you get there before that happens.
And interestingly, because it's bite-sized, you can also bring some rigor to the process that you might not be able to bring if you were trying to do 12 other things at the same time as well. So
yeah,
that's where you... In aerated, you have a number of approaches or number of types of badges, if you like, you can aim for or try and get to, but they're all based on a very particular yes. process and a rigor that you bring to it. So it's a defined outcome. This isn't just saying, I've got ventilation, check. I've got CO2 monitors, check.
Yes, correct. And it's with what we were doing, we were like, okay, well, we've got an air quality performance certification. But we also realize that design can play a massive part in the resultant air quality that you have in a space. So we developed a design product. So we had something that could be implemented from day one, because we have had conversations using our air score design and operations certification all the way back in the planning stages for planning submission. So it was like, how can we prove that we're going to deliver the best, most future-proof building? Okay, well, we'll just spec in a DNO, because that will help showcase that we're trying to future-proof things. We're ahead of the curve. We've thought about sustainability, yes, but we've also thought about healthy buildings. And we were like, okay, so design is sorted, but that's kind of the core design of the building. Then we developed the DNO interiors. So that's looking at the interior design. So material selection, it looks at assessing the air quality post-construction pre-occupancy. It looks at where you're going to put partitions in a space. Lots of different things that would, again, impact the resultant air quality without knowing what that's going to look like yet. And then we've got our annual certification, which promotes this ongoing approach to air quality testing. So again, where you've got other certifications that say, okay, do a test post-completion pre-occupancy, and then there's no mention of anything going forward. We really wanted to promote the fact that it is basically, in a really unglamorous way, like an MOT for a building. So if you're going to make the effort of taking a car down to the shop to make sure that it's still roadworthy, we should probably be making sure our buildings are still work-worthy every year. And on an even better, more kind of sophisticated level, can we introduce ongoing monitoring? So that's where our monthly air score came from. So it's this iteration to say, here's something for the architects, the designers, the developers, all the way through to the people who are going to be using the space. And then again, it's just a case of picking and choosing what's right for you at the right time. So if annual assessment is all that you have budget for right now, you don't have to do continuous monitoring. But it's really good practice to check your space once a year and across different seasons. So let's start there. And then you can get a feel for what these monitors look like and how people are interacting with them in your space. And you can maybe make budget available for them in 2, 3, 5 years time. But it's just making people aware that these things exist in the first place, making them comfortable with how they look, in the space, how you might communicate doing something like this and the change management around that. But just making it super straightforward in terms of what you can do, what that looks like, and what the outcomes are with specific regard to one thing, air quality.
And so do these different standards, are they more of a pick and mix that people choose at the beginning, or are you kind of creating on-ramps for people that where they can, you can almost upsell and say, well, look, we started here, but actually we're finding this has real value. We're going to increase to monthly monitoring and so on and so forth.
It is that upsell. And from our business perspective, brilliant, because we want people to come to us for all things air quality. We want to promote ultimate best practice, which would be ongoing monitoring plus this kind of more formal official certification every year. But we realize in some cases that's just not going to be viable for whatever reason. But it is also, it's good for organizations that do want to push themselves because they see what the end point looks like. They see what the most brilliant all singing, all dancing solution looks like. And then they know where to start. So they know what their starting point is, which is usually nothing. But if they conduct an air score and they know that they have the money to do ongoing monitoring, they also know that they're going to do a heavy refurbishment in 5 years' time, then they can track the performance of their space on an ongoing basis for the next 5 years, knowing that this design for interiors certification exists. So they can implement that at the 5 year mark and then understand with a wealth of data and this design certification exactly how to optimize their space at this heavy refurb point where there is more budget available. So it's working out how to best use that budget when the inevitable happens, when there's going to be an opportunity to.
Have any of your, I'm trying to think how to frame this without it sounding like a gotcha, but.
Oh, be direct.
No, I'm just, we're trying to create on-ramps for the rest of the vast majority of the built environment. And the general consensus mm-hmm. out there is a lot of the built environment performs very badly. Ventilation has never been a central pillar to decisions within most workplaces. There's almost no annual inspection of ventilation systems from a performance perspective. The consensus is if you went out and checked, you're not going to like the results. Would it be fair to say that the customers that you're getting or the types of organizations that are going for badges kind of know they're in a good place already and it's about tweaking and optimizing? Have you had anybody come through where you've gone to do the tests and it's been, holy God, have you, you know, I'm not sure you want the score up for this one. Yeah, kind of thing. Like you've got a bit of work to do. Like, have you found yourself in that environment yet?
Yes.
Okay, interesting.
So to begin with, in the first, because we established December 2018, formally launched March 2020 for our sins. In the first couple of years, it was, oh, this is about air quality. Okay, well, we're going to put our best buildings forward first, which is fine. Again, it's one of those, if this is what you need to do for us to get in there, do it. We'll do your best buildings. And then we had this example of an organization that had a big, very wide-ranging portfolio, everything from completely hermetically sealed box, completely mechanically controlled, all the way down to naturally ventilated in not the best areas. So they took the risk of saying, okay, we would like to do a couple of what we think are our best buildings, but we never know until we monitor them. And we want to do the ones that we think are not going to perform so well, because we want to understand the two ends of the spectrum that we're working with. And from our point of view, we were like, okay, that's great. It's great that you want to take the leap of faith. And also, you don't have to publish the score if you don't want to. So if you undertake the assessment and you find out that it hasn't even got certified, at least you've done it. At least you know. So if anyone comes to query it, if anyone brings in their own monitor and says, this place is, then it's like, yeah, we know, and we are trying to do something. Here's the evidence of us having done a test, and here is, hopefully, the roadmap to improvement. And it might be a five-year roadmap. But at that point, I think people are accommodating the fact that, yes, these things are going to cost money to fix. What are you going to do tomorrow? What are you going to do in 6 months' time, 9 months' time? And what is going to happen in 5 years' time, where more budget becomes available to make those mechanical changes or the heavy duty changes? So that was really interesting to see in the first instance, but it hasn't been an exceptional example. It's been more and more common now that people are feeling more comfortable with the process and more comfortable about the control that they have, because it's their data. We're not going to start publishing things left, right, and center. We're not going to publish people's scores if they don't want them to be published. We've got a record of all buildings with valid certification. So in terms of policing, that's how we do it. But if someone doesn't want to talk about the fact they got silver because it's not gold and it's not platinum or what they wanted to get, then that's fine, because they've probably thought about ways in which they can get to their targeted score, their desired score, or they're happy with their entire portfolio at least being silver or above, which has been the case in some other organizations as well. So yes, I think to begin with, it was definitely a risk-averse decision. I say risk-averse, it's probably quite risky doing something that's voluntary to do with something that you can't see anyway. But of those risk-takers, they were being risk-averse in terms of putting their best buildings forward first. But yeah, it was once they felt comfortable, it was, okay, well, let's unlock the rest of the portfolio because we want to benchmark it. And actually, for those ones that are underperforming, if we can get a gauge on how below par they are, how much investment is actually going to be required to get them to what we deem to be the minimum viable standard for our fund or our portfolio, what are we going to do with them? Are we going to get rid of them? Are we going to keep them and make the investment? If so, what does that look like? But it was a really healthy decision-making situation at that point, because they were doing everything completely data-backed, and it was a very black and white, case-by-case basis. Okay, this one's underperforming. But they would also benchmark it against other things like energy consumption and lots of other metrics, and have this kind of league table of building performance in so many different regards. And if they had a building that was performing badly for a number of things, then maybe that's something that they would look to invest in or get rid of. But at least the decision was being made from a point of data collection.
That's really interesting. And I mean, it's a massively overused saying, but you can't manage what you don't measure. And but to coin a sports term, I think what's probably more important is that you can't be what you don't see. And I think for a lot of organizations, there's this fear that, you know, extremes make bad law. So like just having examples of high performing buildings with badges and disaster assets that you divest from doesn't really teach you anything about the middle ground, which is where the low hanging fruit is and where the chances to make material differences to people's lives are predominantly. You know, tweaking a LinkedIn headquarters building in Dublin isn't going to do much overall. It might, like you say, it might move them from a gold to a platinum or something, but ultimately you're not having a big impact. Where the big impact is in the long tail of the assets out there in the industry. So what I think and my ask would be is we need more case examples and better articulated examples out there in the built environment of organizations that did all right, you know, but could do better. And this was their journey, and this was their fear when they started, and this is what the roadmap actually looked like, because that will resonate, I think, with so many more people than, as nice as it is to have a shiny glass clad image in a brochure with a platinum badge on it, that doesn't resonate with the vast majority of the workforce, I think.
No, it doesn't. And I think what we saw was where our certification was being, or our assessment was being applied to regional assets, which were kind of the mid-tier ones, maybe the slightly poorer performing ones. They were able to do it because the cost, it wasn't going to break the bank to do. Because if you wanted to undertake some of these certifications just to understand the current state of play, it's a really expensive exercise. So a lot of the time it's all well and good to do an air quality assessment. You can do an air quality assessment and maybe get a gauge for how you're performing. But if you're not from the air quality space, you might just be delivered a report that's got pages and pages of tables of numbers and some things in green, some things in amber, some things in red. And it'll just be so difficult to understand, which is where we were like, okay, let's come up with a single metric being the air score. So it's going to be a number out of 10 and then a classification. So actually all you need to look at is that, and you can understand the performance of your indoor air quality. You don't need to know what the specific level of CO2 was unless you want to.
And
we can call that out and talk about
that. You're collecting a range of air quality parameters, both at the low cost sensor ongoing monitoring position, but also in the more annualized, kind of more detailed breakdown of VOCs and what have you. Maybe explain a little bit of that to people so they understand the general frame of what air score is measuring.
Yeah, so we will take data, as you say, from low-cost commercial grade sensors. The parameters that we look at from those types of sensors will be things like temp and humidity, because they are very well done in those types of monitors, CO2, and then PM2.5. The one that is the black sheep of the air quality world is VOCs. And when we're talking about how to make air quality more relatable, and we're talking about, okay, well, PM2.5 doesn't mean anything. Particulate matter, the diameter of 2.5 microns or less, doesn't mean anything. Fine dust. Fine dust, and it comes from these sources. That's what someone needs to know. When we were talking about VOCs, we were like, okay, so VOCs are things that you can smell. However, they can be anything from formaldehyde, which is coming from kind of like highly processed manufactured woods like MDF, or it could be the smell of someone's lunch. So where you've got something like PM2, like fine dust is just dangerous. Its composition might be different, but it's just the nature of what it is makes it dangerous. CO2 is one gas, and there is one message around that. Temp, humidity, same with them. With VOCs, it was becoming very complicated, where we saw high levels of sensor readings to be like, we don't think this is anything to worry about, because you don't have a newly fit out space, you don't have air fresheners, you don't have any point sources that we can see, but your levels are very high. And we would say, don't think there's anything to worry about, but we know that that's not much of a comfort when you're looking at really high readings coming through on the sensor. So very quickly, we were like, we can't continue with sensor data for VOCs. So we flipped to passive sampling, because again, it was a low-cost solution, but it was a low-cost, robust solution. So we have passive sampling, which essentially, they're like these metal tubes that get shipped to site. They sit there, we put them next to a sensor so we can benchmark the lab data versus sensor data. We put them there for a period of 3 weeks. They just sit there passively, comes with the name, collecting air running through them, and then we ship them off to a lab. And the lab will come back with a TVOC, total volatile organic gas reading, and top five organic gases. And the top five help us say, okay, well, your predominant gases were limonene, citronella, things that we know come from cleaning products or air fresheners, which aren't actually fresheners. Cleaning products and air fresheners. Are you using these? In which case, substitution or elimination of these particular things will probably improve your indoor air quality if these levels are high. If it was things like, or different gases that allude to the fact it's coming from coatings and building materials, then you've got a slightly different issue. And it's not something that can't be overcome, but it just needs to be treated with differently. So it was a way of saying, okay, you don't have to, or we don't have to look at air quality or VOC data from sensors anymore. We're just going to take the lab results. You can see patterns and trends using sensor data. So it goes, if you've got recently fit out space and the ventilation's off, then overnight you're probably going to see things trending upwards as materials are off-gassing and releasing these gases, and there's no ventilation to dilute it. First thing in the morning when ventilation comes back on, you see it drop off again to a much lower level, much lower concentration. So sensor data is still valuable. So not undermining it in that way, but it's valuable for a different reason. So we're not using it for concentrations. We're not using it to determine where these VOCs are coming from. We're just using it for patterns and trends, probably mostly related to occupancy and ventilation.
Interesting. So are you, because you've got that split between low cost ongoing monitoring or low cost monitoring for a period of weeks as part of the score, mm-hmm. and you're going to the trouble to put in some passive samplers as well to mm-hmm. break open the TVOC Pandora's box a little bit, yes. and see what's mm-hmm. there. While you're doing that, do you start to have a look at some of the other things in more detail as well? Do you find yourself getting sucked down into, well, actually, it might be interesting to put an NO2 passive sampler in while we're there, or a radon sampler while we're there, or a sulfur dioxide, or you name it, any number of interesting pollutants that you may not have confidence in a low-cost sensor to give you accurate data on, but you might have more confidence in a lab-grade measurement to give it. So are you finding yourself expanding out or being asked to?
Yes. So more the desire to expand out from an internal scientific perspective. So mostly in the air quality department. Marketing don't want to talk about any more parameters if they don't have to. Sales don't want to talk about any more parameters if they don't have to. Our clients don't necessarily want to be bombarded with any more information if they don't have to be. It would be in cases of if we were working on an inner city project and we said, okay, we've monitored these five parameters, VOCs in a bit more detail. Our suggestion would be we do a little bit further testing if you want to in these other key areas. So NO2 would be a prime one to look at in a city location. You might not look at NO2, you might look at ozone maybe if it was a suburban or rural location. So all of these suggestions are made in the report, so it leaves the door open to those that want to know more without us kind of ramping up the scale of what we're doing to again maybe lose the engagement that we're starting to get around people now know what CO2 is, what the drivers for CO2 are. They are understanding better the conversation that we're having around VOCs. I think once we get to a critical point of education, then there's going to be this quite natural integration to our core product of more parameters. For now, it's best practice would suggest that at least on an annual basis, you also monitor NO2 because you're in a location where it would be appropriate to measure this. It wouldn't be overkill at all. Also, if you've got a construction site nearby, we might want to do deeper testing into PM so you can start to understand the composition of PM2.5. It's not just skin flakes, it's construction dust. And actually, what is that made up of, and how much more serious is that? So yes, there is this kind of, in the air quality side of things, it can feel like a runaway train. So you just start getting really excited and like, oh my God, we should start introducing lots of different things. We just need to be careful about how much we do and when we do it in terms of undoing some of the good work that we've done around the communication and understanding. We're pulling people, dragging them, kicking and screaming up to a point where they understand the five fundamental parameters that we've advocated for. And then we'll start to introduce other things. Because this comes into you've spoken about it before, but it was also on your LinkedIn post the other day with this research that's been done by, was it University of Nottingham?
Yeah.
And it's like the top four air quality pollutants that will impact your health. And it included radon and it included NO2. And particulate matter was there as one of the four or one of the five. But the other ones also need to be introduced. But again, it's kind of a slow introduction. of doing
and the
them.
And the risk is that, you know, what you're not trying to do is create a standard. I mean, you know, we know we've got the introduction in the UK, for example, of 40102, which is going to start to frame much more of that rigorous air quality standardization around buildings. But you're trying as a brand, I guess, to tread that fine line between letting the geeks rule the world, which there's always a propensity to do, because we all are talking to Stephanie Taylor earlier in the week from the States, and I was like saying, how do you stop yourself looking at the data and getting involved? You know, when you're trying to scale something, you can't. It's not a consultancy business you're running. So there's this fine balance between wanting to understand everything and accepting that there are some things that you can't. You've got to provide information in a way that's scalable and understandable, because the fact of the matter is, as fascinating as it is to know if it's benzene or toluene that's present in a room, you've lost the room the moment you
it's enough to say, okay, well, these things are from personal hygiene products. So your dominant organic gases are coming from things like perfumes and deodorants and all that sort of stuff. People are like, okay, cool. So it's grouping them in a way that, yeah, makes it relatable, makes it easy to understand. I think, again, with BS40102, it also looks at, so it's more indoor environmental quality, because it also looks at noise, it looks at light. So again, it treads the line of being more holistic than what we're trying to do. And what we're trying to do is basically a communication, education and engagement tool.
Yeah.
So we want to be stuck on buildings and communicated to the people in the buildings or visiting the spaces in a really straightforward to understand way. Because the word air score, it kind of does what it says on the tin. If you're trying to talk to someone about BS40102, unless it's got a catchier name than that, you're going to lose the room by just saying that out loud.
Yeah.
Because I think it's air quality is already very acronym heavy. It's very data heavy. I think if you introduce something that just makes it sound more complicated, then people are just going to lose interest. So particularly when we've spoken to clients, we have done very specific, very tailored messaging to the type of company they are. So with one company, bizarrely, it was they produce tobacco products. So in some ways, it's great that they want to understand the air quality in the space where their people work. They're not exactly advocating for good air quality or good breathing quality with the products they produce. But it was a very interesting example of, okay, how do we position this for this organization who are fundamentally ruining people's lungs in a way that kind of makes sense for what they want to communicate it as. So that was an interesting one. But in another case, we had a company that works in the beauty space. So again, when we sat down to talk about the results of the air score and what is PM2.5, what are VOCs, all this sort of stuff, the minute we started losing the room, it was like, okay, what does this mean to the beauty industry? So actually, air quality, or there are types of air pollution that can cause inflammation and premature aging of the skin. And immediately they were like, what?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And it was like, well, did you know that some of the products that you guys sell have anti-pollution properties? So they protect your skin. If it's like a foundation, they protect your skin against UV. They also are anti-pollution. And they were like, are they? And I was like, well, here's a link to one of the products that you sell that says anti-pollution on it. So not only can you spin it to be an internal, we're looking after our people message, it's also, oh, by the way, do you understand the link between air pollution and premature aging and spots and acne and all these other things, where it can feed into the brand messaging? So it's like what they're practicing and what they're preaching. So it just, and it made sense to them because they could immediately resonate with it. And they were like, oh, okay, so it's not to do with productivity. Forget that. When we talk to the professional services, that's about productivity. When we're talking to the people who have done this because they thought it was a positive thing to do for employee well-being, but actually you can make it work for the business and the sector they're in, then it suddenly unlocks a whole set of new potential and a whole different set of value they didn't even know existed.
That's really interesting. Really interesting. And so how do you see this broadly playing out then over the next, say, 5 years for both kind of air quality awareness and branding of air quality within buildings and how aerated will fit in with that over, say, the next 5 years or so?
So, I mean, I genuinely think it will follow a similar trajectory to energy performance ratings, energy performance certificates, because it will become, not I hope it will become a fundamental pillar of how we track performance of assets. Air quality will be up there with one of those things. The fact we're so fixated on energy is honestly quite bizarre when you think that air quality doesn't get the same attention. I appreciate there are other drivers around energy, but air quality needs to feature in that conversation. So I think, honestly, in the next 5 years, we could see air quality on the brink of mandatory reporting, to the point where you've got something like an EPC, an air PC, an air score type of mandatory requirement that will in itself drive the value of assets. So it won't feed into something like GRESB that ultimately dictates the value of an asset or a fund. It'll be that one specific thing that starts dictating the value. So yeah, in the same way that you've got an EPC, you've got an MOT, it probably needs to be EPC-esque in its uptake and its regulation, but it needs to be MOT-esque in the frequency that it's reported on. So a mix of those two, as I say, very unglamorous things. But I do see the future of air quality. It's here. We now know too much. I feel like the indoor air quality industry is very vocal. We are kind of stuck in our echo chamber, but we are very vocal. But people know too much now. They know it exists. They know it can be monitored. They know it can be benchmarked. It's something that won't be ignored now that the business cases are starting to present themselves as well.
Yeah, it's a hard lid to close that box on, really. Yeah,
definitely.
For sure.
Definitely. And it would be strange if people wanted to. I don't think you can. I think it's that kind of asbestos situation with it now. It's like, okay, we understand it. We know it's the hazards around it. We also know the benefits of doing things with it. So with something like asbestos and lead that used to be in paints, it was like, God, we need to get rid of this because it is literally killing people. With this, it's like, yes, on the very sinister side, it's not doing people any good at all to be in poor working environments or poor living conditions. But also there are so many benefits. So again, coming back to that messaging around, yeah, there's all this horrible stuff, but we shouldn't become fixated on that because here are the amazing things that can be delivered if we do it and we get it right.
Yeah, and I think to your point about the priority that's been placed on energy, one of the challenges the air quality community has had has been drawing a straight line to cost of poor health. Because we operate within buildings predominantly, it's what we've been talking about, mm-hmm. The budgets that are used to improve buildings have been based on reducing carbon emissions and improving energy performance. So they come from a different government department and pool of money than what air quality really is driving efficiency and savings in, which is health and environment and other parts. So I think mm-hmm. that's why the work of Ben et al. Is so important, is creating things like DALI metrics for air quality, puts it in the same mm-hmm. camp as drinking and smoking and road traffic deaths and all of the other population level risk metrics that you can say, hang on a minute, if we can improve air quality at a population level, this is the mm-hmm. rate of return of investment into that space. So it should be coming from the health budget and the built environment budget. You know, it doesn't have to, you know, we're constantly competing basically for energy performance budgets. And I've been saying for years, nothing beats no ventilation for energy savings, you know?
Yeah, which is definitely not the message.
No, no, for sure.
We want people to hear.
And what about yeah, air rated? Right, what's kind of next on the horizon for you guys there?
Well, I think with what we're doing, we're getting the kind of attention from our big clients that means that we are sticky enough that they want to keep going with annual assessment. Because I think that was always the fear, is people would do it once, think they understand their building, stop doing it. We were like, well, things can change. So, and also if you keep doing it, then it will promote ESG, it'll promote CSR, it'll do all these good things. So we're seeing a lot of stickiness with our big landlord clients, and also some big occupier clients. I'm hoping what we can start to do is get into some public sector buildings, start doing more around this kind of mandatory requirement for air quality testing, regardless of whether it is air rated air score or a different seal of approval for buildings, but just something that works not only on a UK scale, because a lot of our clients are international in their reach, something that works on a global scale. So you don't just have an EPC, which is something that like people understand in the UK, but if you said EPC to someone in America, they might not get it. We want this kind of broad global seal of approval for buildings that is mandatory. And I know that is a big ask and it is a big thing to drive towards, but I think it is, particularly in property with these big portfolios, the only way really to start truly benchmarking and truly understanding asset performance.
Yeah, that's a really, really interesting
point. That is my hope for air rated.
And of course, it makes it more affordable if it turns into a recurring revenue model, because you can bake the cost into a longer term relationship with people rather than, you know, having a one hit wonder where they get a certificate. You know, what value is an EPC even 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road?
Yeah.
You know, you lose its building performance value if it's not a recurring team. Yeah.
And if it's recurring, you also incentivize people doing something about it in the interim. It's like, we're coming back. Like, oh yeah. God. Like at least have to make sure it's still maintaining the quality it was when you did the test last year.
Yeah, crap. Did anybody replace the filters when was the last time we did that? Because air score was coming back next month. Yeah.
And it's so much, it's different, because I remember being at school and whenever Ofsted were coming, the flowers would come out in reception. We'd be like, they're never usually here. And everyone was on their best behaviour. With an air quality assessment, everyone could be on their best behaviour, sure, but like you'll still be found out if it's not performing the way it should. So it's one of those things you have to be mindful of the entire time. It's not just one thing 24 hours in advance. Oh God, they're coming in tomorrow, aren't they, to do their installation. Okay, well, we need to suddenly ramp up the vents. I mean, you could, but it's one of those things that you should be mindful of the entire year, as opposed to just putting things in place 24 hours before we get there. It's hopefully it's one of those things that does, well, it is here to stay, hopefully, for most people. I just think the way that you do that is by slowly getting towards a mandatory point, a bit like BREEAM, because BREEAM to begin with was voluntary, and then it became mandatory for public sector, still voluntary for private sector. That's fine, but that's exactly the same position that we want to get ourselves to, but on a global scale, as I say.